Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, March 20th, 2014. Government forces say they have recaptured Malakal.
As far as I'm concerned, it was real fighting, and I am sure some rebels have been killed, although I don't have the real count.
And the presiding judge in the trial of four political detainees decides to resume the trial without seven former detainees asked to return to Juba.
The prosecution wanted to delay the trial on the ground that the seven were not brought and they wanted to wait for the seven. We objected to that vigorously.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's military says it captured the Upper Nile state capital of Malakal from rebel forces this morning. This would mark the fifth time the town has exchanged hands since fighting broke out between pro- and anti-government forces. But forces loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar say they simply made a tactical withdrawal from the town. The SPLA's Information and Public Relations Director, Brigadier Malak Ayuen Ajok, says there were only few casualties on the government side.
What the SPLA reported to the general headquarters was actually one soldier killed and two soldiers wounded. As far as I'm concerned, it was real fighting, and I am sure some rebels have been killed, although I don't have the real count.
Ayuen says he believes casualty figures were relatively low because two sides did not fight on the town's streets.
The fighting was actually initiated by heavy shelling from very far areas and later on armored vehicles that actually moved in. So it was not really fighting between the forces, it was heavy shelling supported by the mechanized forces.
He says the rebels have fled and are heading towards eastern Upper Nile to the areas of Ulang and Nasir. He says SPLA forces are pursuing the anti-government forces. But Rule Roy Kwong, a military spokesman for the anti-government forces, insists his side still controls part of Malakal.
No, they are not in charge of all of Malakal. We just made a deliberate pullback, an organized one. And we are in the southern part, also in the eastern part. They entered Malakal from the north. And they are in the northern part of Malakal.
The Upper Nile State Government has temporarily relocated its institutions from Malakal to Reng. Brigadier Yuen says since the government forces have recaptured the town, there is no point in relocating to Reng. He is also calling on civilians to return to Malakal.
Now that the rebels have been chased away from Malakal, there is no reason why they should not come back to their town and to their houses. They will be protected this time.
That report was prepared by Charlton Doki in Kampala and Lucy Pony in Nairobi. United Nations spokesman Farhan Haq confirms heavy shelling took place yesterday near the UN compound in Malakal between pro- and government forces. Haq says the UN also noted tank and troop movements towards the town.
The mission once again calls on both parties to comply fully with the cessation of hostilities agreement and to ensure a swift establishment of the monitoring and verification mechanism.
Yesterday, UN peacekeeping chief Javier Lissous expressed concern about media attacks on the UN, including newspaper and online articles critical of the UN mission in South Sudan and the UN chief in South Sudan, Helder Johnson. The trial resumed today of four South Sudanese politicians accused of treason for their role in what the government says was an attempted coup, which kicked off months of violence around the country. The hearing was adjourned last week when state prosecutors wanted seven other politicians who were released to the custody of the Kenyan authorities in February to return to South Sudan to also be at the trial. Those politicians were not in court today, as we hear from Philip Aleu in Juba.
Lead prosecutor James Mayan asked the five judges to adjourn the hearing again until the seven former political prisoners returned to South Sudan. Prosecutors went to charge them in connection with the uprising in Juba in mid-December. But presiding judge James Alala ruled that the trial should go ahead. The judges say delaying the hearing will deny speedy justice to the four politicians before the court. Moinluak Alor, the lead defense lawyer, says he is happy with the judge's decision.
It went our way in the sense that the prosecution wanted to delay the trial on the ground that the seven were not brought and they wanted to wait for the seven. We objected to that vigorously, and we asked the court to continue the trial of the four, which the court approved.
Mayan declined to speak to reporters. The prosecution called for two witnesses today, including the commander of the presidential guard, Marial Chanua. He testified that the four politicians in the dock, Pagana Amom, Majanga God, Oyaiding, and Ezekiel Garkwas, were part of a group that instigated the fighting that erupted in Juba in mid-December. Chanua said that when the fighting started, soldiers ignored his orders and broke into the armory at the headquarters of South Sudan Ground Forces to take rifles. It has found that 76 senior officers and 730 soldiers failed to turn up for the morning parade the day after the violence started and are believed to have rebelled. Anthony Alor says the defense will cross-examine the prosecution witnesses tomorrow before they present their own case.
We have witnesses. There will be time when the court will ask us for witnesses and we will declare them publicly in the court.
The prosecution is scheduled to continue presenting its case tomorrow. For BOA News, I'm Philippa Leo in Juba.
After several days of recess, the third round of peace talks between South Sudan government and forces loyal to rebel leader Riek Machar are set to begin tomorrow in Addis Ababa. The talks were supposed to begin today, but as Lucy Pony reports from Nairobi, the delegates have just started arriving in Addis Ababa.
The delegates to the talks had been given 2 weeks by the IGAD mediators to consult and prepare for direct talks on national issues. It appears little or no progress was made at the last round of talks, which ended on 6th March 2014. Anti-government delegate Goi Joyuliol, speaking from Addis, says he welcomes this latest round of talks but still has a major concern.
But there are a lot of issues on the table, including the seven. The government doesn't want them to participate in the talks. They release detainees. Tomorrow we're going to find out the exact position. But otherwise, we don't have any major problems.
Last week, IGAD agreed to deploy a protection and deterrent force to protect the monitoring and verification mechanisms as well as key government installations, a move welcomed by the government. However, the anti-government delegates are opposed to the move. Again, Goi Joyuliol.
You know, we are very optimistic about the whole process being handled by IGAD through a dialogue. We were just worried a little bit about the troops that had to be brought in and all this, because we were not informed in the first place, and there's a lot of things we need to discuss about.
Goi says his side will make a decision after hearing from IGAD on the troop deployment and the participation of the seven former detainees. Meanwhile, the government and anti-government forces have repeatedly traded accusations over violating the cessation of hostilities agreement signed in late January. There have been calls for more inclusive talks in this round, such as bringing in civil society organizations. Whether or not that will happen remains to be seen. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Nairobi.
Ugandan officials acknowledge there has been tension between some South Sudanese refugees and residents living near their settlement over access to resources. Officials say they are trying to work out a compromise with the host communities to encourage them to accept the new arrivals. Bonifacio Taban traveled to a refugee settlement in Adjumani district and has this report for VOA.
William Obuildings is the chairperson of the Ayilo refugees camp in Adjumani. The camp housed 50,000 refugees who fled their home during the fighting in South Sudan. He said there has been some minor disagreements with people living nearby after a handful of refugees chopped down some trees to build fires.
They interfere by threatening some ladies and even young men when they go to cut some trees, but not in most cases. Some cases, even yesterday on 18 yesterday, they attacked one of the refugees call Bolgarang Chok, was assaulted, beaten, but we handled. We talked to them so that they will not repeat.
Ilegu Andrea live a few meters away from the camp. She has not to be recalled, but told BOA the problem is that the refugees will not listen to the host community's request. He say local asked several times that refugees not cut down the trees, which are reserved for lodgings. Andrea said it was the refugees that assault the community members, not the other way around. Titus Jogo, a protection officer based in Adjumani, said they are working to cease the tension between the two groups. He said they have security committee which have been traveling between the camps and the community to encourage people to live together peacefully.
And we have also set a technical team from the district which is also going to begin visiting the settlements with effect from this Friday, talking about the need for peaceful what existence, and this can only be generated through sharing available resources that are on the ground.
Jogo said he believes it will just take time for the two communities to live side by side. He says some things the refugees should keep in mind is that the local community volunteered the land, so they were obviously willing to work with the refugees.
The reception has been so good because even the government of Uganda does not have land here. The local communities here themselves have come up and said, yes, we know the government is facing a challenge, but bring these people and settle them on land. That is a big achievement as far as peaceful coexistence is concerned.
Jogo said they are also working with development partners to improve the refugees' camp so that the South Sudanese are not as dependent on the Ugandan community. He said they hope to have more borehole up and running within a month. For BOA News, I'm Boniface Yetaban in Adjumani Districts.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
In recent years, Africans have made progress in the fight against HIV/AIDS. Prevention programs, new medicines, and changes in behavior have brought infection rates down dramatically. But this success could be in danger if people are not careful about sexual activity. Those displaced from their homes by war and civil unrest are at a greater risk of sexual violence, which can spread the disease. Advice and information are available from health centers in many areas. So understand the risks, take precautions, and protect yourself from HIV/AIDS.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, relations between South Africa and Rwanda have gone from bad to worse. Stay tuned.
South Sudan in Focus listeners can find us on the following shortwave frequencies: 12080, 11790, and 11905 kilohertz. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan, or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what benefits, if any, have foreign business people brought to your country?
They've managed to bring in money, of which it has helped to build factories. These factories have employed many people.
The benefit that foreign business, for instance, when you look at the GSM, particularly common employment for people.
If we would have more of these companies coming into this country, we would be able to reduce the issue of, first of all, unemployment, and we'd also be able to increase our non-oil revenue, which I think is very important.
I've changed for the better. Ours are going for the worst. This makes me conclude that these guys have benefited more than I have.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
In Sudan, renewed violence in the Darfur region has left more than 100,000 people homeless. Amnesty International says the nature of the conflict in Darfur has changed over the years, and the latest violence is mainly intercommunal fighting. For VOA, Muhammad Yusuf has more on the story from Nairobi.
Amnesty International's new report entitled "We Can't Endure Anymore" details how armed men from both government-linked militias and rebel groups target civilians and subject them to abuses and killings. The report also documents attacks and counterattacks against civilians as the Salamat and the Maseria tribes continue to fight in central Darfur. Michelle Kagari is Amnesty's East Africa Deputy Director. She says her organization has documented human rights violations that amount to war crimes.
We've had specific killings, targeting their villages with a view to destroying their livelihoods, so burning down the villages, burning down the fields, stealing people's livestock, destroying mills and irrigation systems. And of course, we've documented sexual and gender-based violence against women and girls.
11 years ago, the Sudanese government launched counter-insurgency military action after rebel groups began an uprising in Darfur. Years of violence led to the deaths of more than 300,000 people and displaced about 3 million. The International Criminal Court has since indicted Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir on charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide in the region, and issued a warrant for his arrest. Peace efforts by the government of Qatar and the East African regional bloc IGAD have largely stalled, and fighting still continues between the pro-government militias and various rebel factions. Abdullah Adam Katir, a writer and a political analyst based in Khartoum, says it is time to open a peace forum for all warring groups in Darfur so they can all be involved in the peace process.
Some people are suggesting that why the different forms of peace that is in Addis Ababa and in Doha and in other places, why don't they get them all together and one Sudanese forum for peace for all Sudan? But nobody knows if this could be taken to the consideration and if the international community will take it ahead or not.
After weeks of fighting, British charity Oxfam says many of the civilians who have fled have no access to essential humanitarian assistance and are able to reach safety. To help the desperate population, Oxfam has launched a relief operation aimed at reaching more than 90,000 people. Oxfam Sudan's country director El Fattah Osman says the affected people want peace more than anything.
People need more than just clean water or food. They need safety. They need to know that their families and communities are safe from any future attacks. People need peace, need stability in Darfur.
Kagari of Amnesty International is calling on international actors to do more to stop the suffering and killings of the civilians.
There has been almost guaranteed impunity from the start. And 11 years on, we are seeing more of the same, with civilians being constantly harassed and being chased from their homes and being specifically targeted. Therefore, it is time, it is long overdue that the international community got serious and tackled this impunity.
Meanwhile, the United Nations African Union mission in Darfur reports the situation in Safar Omar, North Darfur, has returned to relative normalcy after the rival communities agreed to end hostilities. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The deadly Boko Haram insurgency gripping northeastern Nigeria has intensified in recent months, and some Nigerians say it could destroy the ruling party's chance of winning next year's election. But some analysts say the insurgency is being used as a political weapon for both sides. Heather Maddock reports for VOA from Abuja.
No candidates have announced that they are running for president, but Nigeria's 2015 elections are already expected to be the most hotly contested in the country's history. In the northern states, where attacks blamed on Boko Haram continue to grow more frequent and more vicious, some leaders say if the region is not secured, President Goodluck Jonathan cannot win. More than 700 people have been killed this year alone, and nearly 500,000 are displaced from their homes. Schools across the region were closed this week after a series of massacres and school burnings. Khalid Alihu Abubakar is the Secretary General of Jamaatu Nasril Islam, a prominent Islamic organization in Nigeria.
One of the most fundamental mandates of each government is to provide security. And there's no excuse this country or this leadership can give of not being able to provide the required security.
Others say in the past 10 months, military rule in three northeastern states has prevented the insurgency from spreading. In the oil-rich Niger Delta region, the heart of Mr. Jonathan's support base, Gabriel Osekene, a member of the ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says violence in only three of Nigeria's 36 states will not change the outcome of the elections.
How many states are we talking about this Boko Haram? If you think about this issue of Boko Haram, we have only just three major states that are talking about this Boko Haram.
Nigeria's ruling PDP has won every election since the country became a democracy in 1999. The 2015 elections, however, could be different. For the first time, opposition parties have merged, forming a single powerful bloc called the All Progressive Congress, or APC, bent on ousting the PDP. Thomas Hansen, a senior analyst for Africa at Control Risks, says both the PDP and the APC are already using the insurgency as a political tool.
The APC are likely to claim that the continuation of the Boko Haram insurgency in the north demonstrates that the government lacks control over the security situation. Then, on the other hand, supporters of the ruling PDP are likely to claim that Boko Haram is being tacitly supported or sponsored by elements in order to undermine the image of government.
Hansen says the security crisis could also impact the voting itself in the north, especially in Borno, Yobe, and Adamawa, the three states under emergency rule.
It's still very unclear if the security situation will improve enough for the elections to be held there. I think elsewhere in northern Nigeria, there are also likely to be security issues that will deter some voters from going to the polling stations.
Even without the Boko Haram issue, Nigerian elections are notoriously tense, with political divisions falling along the same lines as religious and ethnic divisions. Nigeria's Electoral Commission says it is working with security agencies to prepare for next year's vote. In 2011, more than 800 people were killed in post-election violence in northern Nigeria. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced new sanctions against Russia for its annexation of Crimea. Speaking in the White House Rose Garden today, the president said he is imposing sanctions on more individuals involved in Russia's occupation of the Black Sea Peninsula. Earlier, the United States placed sanctions limiting travel and economic activity on 21 people involved in the Kremlin's actions against Ukraine. The president also said he is considering expanding sanctions further to apply to sectors of the Russian economy. Meantime, Russia's lower house of parliament, the State Duma, has overwhelmingly ratified a treaty to annex Crimea from Ukraine. The lawmakers voted on the measure today, and the parliament's upper house, the Federation Council, will hold a similar vote tomorrow. Crimeans voted in a regional referendum last Sunday to declare independence from Ukraine in hopes of joining the Russian Federation. And finally, Taliban suicide bombers and gunmen stormed a police station in the eastern Afghan city of Jalalabad early this morning, killing at least 11 people, including 10 policemen, and wounding some 20 others. Authorities say seven suicide bombers coordinated to blow open a path into the building, then detonated their explosives once inside. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
Relations between South Africa and Rwanda have sharply deteriorated since the murder of a Rwandese opposition activist living in Johannesburg. Over the last 3 months, there has been an armed raid, diplomatic explosions, and increasingly bitter accusations. Peter Cox has more for VOA from Johannesburg.
It has not been a good few months for diplomatic relations between South Africa and Rwanda. Two high-profile Rwandans who'd sought asylum in South Africa were attacked. A former Rwandan intelligence chief, Peter Kariega, was found strangled to death in his Johannesburg hotel room on New Year's Day. Then, in early March, armed men broke into the safe house of former Rwandan military chief, Faustin Niyomwasa. The South African government said it was an attempt on his life. Kariega and Niamwasa had a lot in common. Both had a falling out with Rwandan President Paul Kagame. Both sought refuge in South Africa. And both were among former top army officers who started an exiled opposition party. South Africa accused four Rwandan diplomats of playing a part in the attack on Niamwasa's home and expelled them. In return, Rwanda, which has denied any link to either case, kicked out six South African diplomats. Kofi Kweku is an Africa analyst at the University of Witwatersrand School of Governance in Johannesburg. He says the recent developments show that South Africa cannot protect asylum seekers.
In fact, South Africa is quite kind and very meek to a large degree. South Africa is very weak in its response to what's been happening on its own territorial integrity, where you have people violating it, assassinating other people. So there's a grave issue of security, but also most important, insecurity in South Africa. So anybody can walk into the territory of South Africa and do whatever they want to do and then just leave. And that is sending a wrong signal.
Rwandan officials have long maintained that some of the anti-Kagame dissidents living abroad, including those in South Africa, have planned or carried out grenade attacks against Rwandans. Foreign Minister Louise Mushikiwabo posted a series of tweets in March accusing South Africa of protecting terrorists while expelling law-abiding diplomats. Meanwhile, Rwanda has denied all allegations that it targets political opponents at home or abroad. But at the same time, President Kagame also seems intent on sending a message to his former allies. In the weeks after Kariega's murder, he said, "You cannot betray Rwanda and get away with it. There are consequences for betraying your country." With tensions so public, what is the next step for South Africa and Rwanda? Weston Chilaho is a research fellow of African diplomacy and foreign policy at the University of Johannesburg. He says while tensions have escalated, it seems that both countries have left room for negotiation, with neither government expelling the heads of their respective diplomatic missions. He notes Rwanda is an important player and ally in Africa's Great Lakes region, and South Africa is very important for Rwanda, as it helped the country rebuild after the genocide and has given Rwandans cheap education in South Africa.
I don't think they will fall out entirely. My take is that they'll find a way of meeting each other and resolve this matter and try and bring the diplomatic relations back to where they were before now.
In the meantime, South Africa's Department of International Relations has issued a stern warning that action will be taken against any individual or group that abuses the human rights laws of the country. Peter Cox for VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's our show for this Thursday. We'll leave you with the song Anna Sudani by Gordon Kong. We have been listening to Gordon Kong with the song Anna Sudani. I'm your host, John Tanza, in Washington. We are glad you could be here. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
We are winner. I said I'm not yet.